This holiday season, comfort means slowing down and finding calm amid the chaos. Create your natural oasis by prioritizing rest, comfort, and connection with Avocado Green Mattress. As the holidays fill up with gatherings and to-do lists, Avocado mattresses and home essentials provide the foundation for deeper rest, calmer mornings, and a healthier daily routine. Every product is thoughtfully made with the planet in mind, so you can feel good about the comfort and quality you bring into your home. Avocado is better for you and better for the planet. And to make your purchase more accessible, you'll have easy financing options with Affirm. Prioritize rest and recharge with Avocado's organic comfort. Head to avocadogreenmattress.com today to create your natural oasis and save big during their holiday sale. Avocado, dream of better.
Welcome to the Nation Podcast, where we take you behind the scenes of our biggest stories with the journalists who wrote them. I'm Dede Guttenplan, special correspondent for The Nation. Perhaps no single object embodies our dystopian, oligarchical, ugly present more than the Tesla Cybertruck, the hulking spacecraft-cum-tank that Elon Musk has foisted on the world. The Cybertruck is ugly to look at, unsafe to drive, and judging from its anemic sales, unwanted by most of the public. It has been described as an even bigger flop than the infamous Ford Edsel. But as writer Maya Vinokur discovered, none of that seems to matter to the Cybertruck's most loyal fans. In What Was the Cybertruck?, a piece for our November issue, Vinokur journeyed deep into the heart of the small but fierce Cybertruck cult and found a group of people, or more accurately, men, eager to defend the car against all enemies, domestic and foreign. We're delighted to have Maya Vinokur on to discuss what the Cybertruck is, was, and what it represents. Maya, thanks so much for joining us on the Nation Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
I want to start by asking you a perhaps unusual question for the Nation, which is about your automobile genealogy. And I'll illustrate what I mean by starting with mine so that listeners know where I'm coming from. My first car was a 1962 MGA, which I bought a half interest in, a long time ago when I got my driver's license. That was followed by a 1966 Volkswagen bus, and that was followed by a 1974 Ford Impala with a brief detour to England where I had a Morris Traveler. Then a 1965 Volvo 544, and then a 1988 Toyota Land Cruiser. None of these cars were bought new. I think the newest one that I bought was the Toyota, which was 10 years old when I bought it, and which, by the way, I'm still driving. And my only new car purchase was a 2005 Toyota Prius, which my ex-wife is still driving. So that's me and cars. Now you.
Well, I have a much less exciting and storied past with cars because after getting my driver's license when I was 16, like a normal person, then I didn't drive for many, many years. I lived in cities where I didn't need a car. And we actually only got like the first car that I have owned and driven as an adult is our family Subaru. So which like we bought it during the pandemic. So I, in many ways, I'm exactly the wrong kind of person to write this piece because I know I'm not a gearhead. I'm barely a competent driver, to be honest. So I think actually that was, you know, in many ways, like this is one of the reasons why I could never truly understand the Cybertruck. I could never hope to really get it in the way that it's the people who really love it do.
And yet something obviously drew you to the topic. What was that?
I mean, it's such a sign of the times. There's just something about it that really is, it encapsulates so much about our present moment for me. Just the garishness, the what to me, again, as a like car noob, seem like very impractical features, like the fact that you can't really see out the back very effectively if the rear gate is closed. And the fact that that whatever its flaws, people just obsess over it, and that the obsession goes beyond just like the normal kinds of fandoms that we might be used to into like hate speech, violence.
I mean, I have a long history of car ownership because I'm an old guy, but it is true that people come to, and by people, maybe I do mean men, although I don't think of it that way, but maybe I should, come to irrationally fierce relationships with their vehicles. And let me be like really crudely Freudian for a minute and posit that it's because men have external genitalia that the existence of a steel exoskeleton makes us feel safer.
I mean, it's funny because like you would think, you know, if you have external genitalia, like what more do you need? You know, why have more stuff on top? You know, you would think you could send a subtler message. I don't know.
Because you're going around exposed to the world.
Yeah, maybe that makes sense. But then you would want an exoskeleton that actually kept things out and or like was less flammable.
And the pieces weren't going to fall off on the road. Yeah, no, but, you know, when you talked about irrational attachment, I was reflecting on the fact that, you know, as not only a good lefty, but, you know, longtime Nation person, I'm very well aware that it was in our pages that Ralph Nader first wrote Unsafe at Any Speed, his scathing indictment of the Chevy Corvair. And yet, if you go to, for example, Cambridge, Massachusetts, or any other hive of, you know, self-styled independent thinkers, you're liable to find a fair number of vintage Corvairs in fabulous condition being driven around by people whose politics are a lot closer to Noam Chomsky's than to Elon Musk. So people just fall in love with these things. But you had an interesting approach to why people fall in love or why men fall in love, particularly with the Cybertruck. You described it as a bingo card of stereotypically masculine wants and fears. So tell me what you meant by that.
Yeah, I mean, it just, you kind of hit the nail on the head with the Freudian the external genitalia thing that you just said. I think that it really conveys this kind of inviolability and invincibility in the face of unpredictable, terrifying obstacles. You know, this is a car that at least visually it really looks like you could run over your enemies, you could escape a bunch of zombies, you could be on another planet, you can be in any environment, you can wade, you can it looks like it's a really good protection against everything that might come at you, but it also is, it's not protecting you in a subtle way, it's protecting you in a way that really signals to others like back off. And that, so like it combines everything that people seem to be afraid of, especially now, with really aggressive signaling. Actually, like one thing that I've noticed since writing this is that I've become very attuned to the types of, not just to the types of cars that people drive, but to the types of things that they put on to the surfaces of their cars. Right. Like maybe you've seen this around, like many times Jeeps will have, there's a specific bumper sticker that Jeep owners get that says, "You wouldn't get it. It's a Jeep thing." It's like, why have you put this on your Jeep? we see that you have a Jeep. It says Jeep right on it. I also once saw a Mercedes where the license plate was S class. And it's like, again, why? It's like people really want to, they really want to double down. They really want to say like, I belong to a particular kind of group. My purchasing of this car is my way of signaling belonging to a group.
No, and I think that's, you know, the article is a brilliant exploration, and you clearly had fun while being appalled getting to know these Tesla owners or these Cybertruck owners. And I think, you know, the groupthink thing is very interesting. First of all, what do you say to these people? How do you get them to talk to you?
I did very little to get them to talk to me. And in fact, I said it how it was. I said like I was writing about the site. I said what to me what seemed like a very innocuous kind of thing, which is I'm a writer and I'm writing about this phenomenon that has gone clearly it's gone beyond just like, this is just a car. Tell me a little bit about that. And immediately people were infuriated by the idea that I would be writing about the culture of the Cybertruck as opposed to the nuts and bolts of the Cybertruck or the innovation, the
quick acceleration or whatever. Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, I don't know what any of these people would be like in real life. That's the thing. Like everybody, you know, on the internet, nobody knows you're a dog, et cetera. So maybe they're perfectly nice people in real life, but online they were much like the Cybertruck itself. Like they were quick to bristle and they had many, many memes that they really wanted me to see urgently. And, you know, they were mad.
And what were the memes designed to get you to do? Were they designed to change your mind or?
They were not, they were just like that, you know, the Jeep bumper sticker. They were not designed to make me change my mind because also I didn't tell them, I wasn't, you know, I didn't go in there saying, this car you guys love really sucks. Why don't you tell me about that? I went in being like, I don't know. I mean, I didn't enjoy driving it, but that doesn't mean that somebody else couldn't. And I'm wondering, like, what makes owning this car worth it to you? Like, why is it cool for you to own this car? And they didn't believe that I was sincerely interested in that question. And so the memes were designed to get me to go away, I think.
Well, let's drill down a little bit. I mean, I do want to get to the, you know, this, we try to provide a reader service here at The Nation, and I want to get to the, you know, driver's road and track portion of the of the experience.
Yes, but, let's do it.
All right, so you're in the Cybertruck. What do you notice as you're trying to get into the Cybertruck? Because you wrote a little bit about that.
I did, yeah. Well, so the Cybertruck can raise up really high to protect you from enemies, but it can also go down like pretty low. So it can be, depending on like where you left the suspension, it can be hard to get into. I'm not a very tall person. So I felt the way that I always feel when I get into a gigantic vehicle, which is that I'm like, you know, I'm entering like the Hall of the Mountain King or something. It just, it's intimidating off the bat.
Isn't there also a problem with the door handle?
At the dealership, right, they don't, it, because normally if you own the Cybertruck, then you can use your phone to get into it, which I think is, it itself strikes me as being, like, there's so many things that can go wrong there. But so you can use your app to get in. I think that you can also have, like, a card, like, kind of like a hotel key card to get in. But at the dealership, it was not seamless. You couldn't just like pull the handle and come in. You had to, the guy had to go, he had to like get his app correctly authorized. Then he had to like put it up to the door or whatever, show it to the camera. Then you have to like press the handle because it's not a normal, it's like the handles are like flat against the car in that way that Tesla has been doing for years. So when you're opening the door, it's not easy. And then you have to clamber in. So yeah, you're already like, you really have to want to get into the Cybertruck as its owner, yeah, or user. You have to really want to get in there to get in.
So where did you actually test drive it, Maya?
So I test drove it in twice, once in Meatpacking in Chelsea, mm-hmm. and once in Brooklyn. And in Chelsea, there just isn't space to really like get going with the Cybertruck. You drive around the block and then you return to the dealership and you just, I mean, it's horrible to drive it in New York because it's, the streets are narrow. People are walking every which way and
they hate you.
It just, and they hate you. They hate you. Although nobody, I mean, it's like right around the Tesla dealership. Maybe you're less likely to encounter somebody who is not expecting to see a Tesla Cybertruck right at that moment. In Brooklyn, so you can like drive around on the cobblestones, but you can also, which is what we did, you can like go onto the highway and travel to the IKEA parking lot. So that was how I drove. Either way, you're allowed to take it for a real test drive where they don't send someone with you. But again, because I'm not, I don't feel confident behind the wheel like of a giant car. So both times I asked someone to come with me. And I think if I hadn't, I would have been very confused.
So when you're driving, you said you don't have a ton of driving experience, but how does it compare to driving a normal car?
There's just so much, there are so many more options. There are so many things that, so many more things that you could minutely customize, some of which don't have nothing to do with driving. Like you could make the entire interior of the car glow purple if you wanted to. Like you could have mood lighting. I know you can turn on whatever music as usual, but there's just like there's a lot of stuff that you can customize to make your experience like a very specific way. And I didn't need to do that. Certainly, I didn't need to do that for test drive, and I'm not sure I would need to do it as if I owned one. And I found that I just longed for knobs. I longed for knobs and dials. I wanted to be able to just control stuff with touch, and not on a big screen that I found enormously distracting.
And so I got the sense that it kind of forces you to look at the screen rather than out the window or out the
It
windshield.
does force you to look at the screen. I will say that this is a common complaint, as I understand it, about the car of today, is that it offers very little in the way of conventional knobs and dials. And there's been a movement toward like putting everything on a single touch screen. But I think Tesla was doing this on the earlier side, like just offloading all functionality into like this gigantic iPad that is all that you can look at. And it really, because like most things are controlled from the screen, you have to look at it kind of a lot. And because the visibility around the car is not the best, so as I wrote, there's no real way to see out the back if the gate, the tonneau is closed. So you have to look at the screen to understand what's going on around you. The car is equipped with, I think, six cameras around its perimeter.
It's like a cross between an iPad, a bachelor pad, and a fortress.
Yes, it's like if you like it's like a tour bus or like the back of a limo, like a fancy limo where there's drinks and things or lights or whatever.
And yet my sense is, and this is not scientific, it's purely anecdotal. I've probably seen half a dozen different Cybertrucks being driven. In every case except one that I can recall, there was only one person in them. So it's not like this is the car that you get for your chauffeur to drive you.
No, it doesn't seem like that at all, because the whole point is supposed to be that the driving experience itself is supposed to be so incredible that you wouldn't outsource it to your chauffeur. And plus, it's supposed to be self-driving, in scare quotes.
I mean, scare quotes is exactly the word. You described or reminded me of, and maybe you could give a little more detail about this poor person who was trusting the self-driving feature and therefore got killed.
Yes, there is at least one person where, according to the reports, this person collided with a tractor trailer, and the guy driving the tractor trailer later said that, or somebody who's on the scene reported seeing that this guy was like watching Harry Potter on his phone or something while he was, instead of driving, because he was relying on full self-driving, so-called full self-driving. And yeah, the same person had recorded, they were like doing a series of like YouTube recordings documenting their experience with their Cybertruck.
Until they died.
Yeah, until they died. It's like it's really sad and really horrible. But I think people think that full self-driving really works, and I think that they believe that they can do something other than watch the road when they're in the Cybertruck. And I think that's just not true.
Well, there's I gather that it's not just the Tesla that has increasingly automated driver assist things. Other cars seem to be having it. I mean, as listeners will recall from my automobile genealogy, none of my cars is modern enough to have any of that stuff. But I gather that if you get a new car, you're more likely to get it. When Tesla says, sells you this self-driving thing, it has an asterisk after it.
It's called, I got a real kick out of this. It's called full self-driving in parentheses supervised. So they really want to emphasize the owner's manual, and all of their marketing copy really emphasizes that. The feeling you get when you read it is that someone's like really wanting to like enter the fray, and like somebody is holding them back, and they really want to go oh, it's totally autonomous. It does all the work for you. And then like there's somebody behind them
Lawyer.
being like, no, yeah, a lawyer being like, you're sorry, you can't say that. So it's very like it's full self-driving, but you can never stop paying attention to the road. You can it may never stop. It may not react to traffic lights the way that you would expect something that's being described as autonomous will do. It just will it like it could do surprising things, and you can never actually leave it unsupervised in the way that you could if it were truly full self-driving.
Well, I'm told that there are now these self-driving taxis, San Francisco, and they're testing them
Yeah,
in New York.
Waymos, right?
Yeah.
Yes, yes, and maybe that will work. I really don't know.
It's one thing to opt out of driving a Tesla. It's another thing to opt out of crossing the street in San Francisco or New York, lest
That's
you get.
right. And like you can't, that's right. That's the problem, right? Like, and that's why, when the Cybertruck gets like a 5-star safety rating from the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, you have to wonder like what is that based on if that's exactly right. Like as a pedestrian, you really want to stay all the way away from a Cybertruck if possible.
Yeah, there's another. One of the many joys of your piece is the sort of the linguistic bit, and your attention to the sort of Tesla language. So they have this function now, and I read this as their language, but maybe this is just you with your tongue in your cheek. So please enlighten me. They have something called Actually Smart Summon. Is that
Yes,
what
I
they
and
really call it
that is
that?
their they really call it that. That is not, I would love like it of course it's fun to invent stupid acronyms, but like that is just a true thing about how they describe this function that I don't think works.
Their
Maybe there's
acronym for
been
that is the evocative ASS, and what is it supposed to do?
That's right. That is actually like genuinely cool if it existed for real. So that's supposed to be a function where if you parked your car somewhere and you don't know where you left it, you can activate something in your phone and your car will autonomously make its way to you. I wrote this in the piece, like as somebody who constantly forgets where she parked, I would greatly benefit from such a thing if it existed.
I spent the night before the election in 2016 walking the streets of Manchester, New Hampshire, having gone there to cover Trump's last rally, and having no idea where I'd left my car.
Yeah, so you like imagine there's like so many situations where that would be incredibly useful. But I think that the choice of acronym is very like, Musk called his cuts organization Doge, right?
Right.
Like the department. So like it's I think it's just all it's like all
An in-joke.
yeah, it's all an in-joke. I don't know how much of an in-joke it is to call something ass, but maybe Musk's perspective, it's funny.
If you're 15, it's really funny. Yeah.
It's the best. Yeah, that's the best kind of humor.
And I guess I don't have a whole lot of enthusiasm for defending Elon Musk. And I will say that when they announced the Cybertruck, and I first read the announcement, before we knew that Musk had any politics other than being an enthusiast of electric cars, I thought, oh, an electric truck, that could be cool. And then they released the drawings, and it just looks so hostile, It's like,
It is hostile. It's meant I think it's meant to look hostile.
yeah. Well, I thought, like, if I was in Mad Max, this is the sort of thing that I would appeal to me if the bulletproof windows really worked. But as you reminded us, when they first tested them by throwing metal balls at them, they shattered. So,
They shattered, yeah. I was gonna say that I think there's at least one video out there of somebody shooting a gun at the side of the truck and it being really expecting it to be bulletproof, and it's just not.
yeah, well, I don't know where we go with that except to note that when Tesla's sales were slumping because of Doge, Trump said he was going to buy one. So, but there's a phrase you use that I really like, which is you call it a paradigmatic consumer object because it perfects the art of expensive disappointment. And I want to unpack that phrase, expensive disappointment, and what you mean by that and how how we respond to that, not just with the Cybertruck, but as consumers more generally.
I mean, again, this is like, this is one of the things that makes the Cybertruck really stand out to me as something that represents our time, because so many things are expensive disappointments. You know, like I think this is an experience that all of us are familiar with, where maybe it's just me naively imagining that a high price is an indicator of quality still. And that just is not the case anymore. And in fact, it seems like often things are priced for hype. They're not priced for really any other purpose. If we believe in the idea of prices as signals, like they tell us something about the value of the underlying good, like something has gone wrong there, because they don't signal anything of use to the consumer. High prices, I mean. So yeah, it's to be able to say, like, I paid a huge amount of money for thing X, even if thing X doesn't do even the stuff that the ads say that it's going to do.
Well, you go on to say, in a country run by scam artists, all that's left is the illusion of autonomy and control. And so, you know, there's a way in which I suppose that's the point of the Cybertruck, is that it exposes our delusions as both consumers and political actors.
Yeah, I mean, it really like, a you know, going back to the bingo card metaphor, like it just appeals to people's desire to feel protected and to feel impervious, because the way that things are going, we're all more and more vulnerable instead, and it kind of doesn't matter, you know, on the level of the, like, I don't know, I'm not sure that there was a lot of like thinking about who the target market was for the Cybertruck, because Elon Musk, according to one book, said that he didn't care if they sold. But the type of person who would buy a Cybertruck, maybe that's like a luxury good, right? It's priced quite high, but it's not priced so high that somebody who isn't going, you know, somebody who's like in the market for a big, powerful truck could spend that amount of money on it. But it speaks to the need to be protected, to be invincible, to be powerful, to be free, to be autonomous in some way. But it's coming at this moment when those forms of protection are less available than ever. Autonomy is less available than ever, true autonomy.
Well, you know, it's really interesting, because, you know, you anatomize brilliantly the ways in which, if you invest a significant amount of money in a purchase that's tied to your identity, and the purchase turns out to be disappointing, rather than acknowledge that, you just dig in deeper. You know, whether it's a Cybertruck or, I don't know, a pair of, you know, really expensive designer high heels that are supposed to render you irresistible, or whether it's, you know, a fancy designer suit or whatever, you know, whatever people spend a lot of money on and then turns out not to change their lives in the way that they think it's going to, you know, or whether it's, I don't know, whatever that treatment is. This is radio, so people can't see my extremely high forehead, but whatever that treatment is that's supposed to grow hair, and, you know, men pay for it and they use it for years and they have just as much hair as they started, but they're still paying for it. Because they're invested in the idea that they're doing something, I guess.
That's right. And you could extend it even further to, like, any type of personal investment that you make, monetary or otherwise, into something that's connected to your identity. It's not just, I mean, like, obviously I'm like somewhat making fun of some of these people, but in another way I'm saying, like, you know, we are them, they are us. Like, it's again, this is an experience that's familiar to everybody, where you really want something to work and you really put a lot of yourself into it, and then even when it fails in some way, it's impossible to disconnect, whether because of sunk costs or just because now your identity is synonymous with this thing. This is how cults work, famously, right?
Right.
To admit that failure is more, it feels like it would destroy your entire person, because it's like sort of somehow like all interconnected now.
I mean, it's interesting because it's, as you illustrate so beautifully, it's in many ways just a more extreme example of extremely common experiences and delusions. I mean, you know, a certain kind of man will buy a Cybertruck, but on the other hand, if you get on the road and you look at the people in Volvo XC90s or Toyota Land Cruisers or people in Chelsea in Manhattan in enormous Range Rovers, you know, they're all partaking of a certain level of pedestrian murdering delusions about being safe because they're high up and they're surrounded by expensive metal. And, you know, and does that, I mean, it's more extreme in the Cybertruck, and of course, bits of the Cybertruck fall off, so it renders its pretense to invulnerability a little more comical. But
yes, I mean, and if we like return to Freud, then everything that we're doing is just like trying to resist the death drive, or like everything we're doing is just because we're like afraid of our own mortality. And like maybe if we have something with 16 airbags that has like triceratops spikes on the outside, like that will keep us safe, prevent us from dying. You know, it's all, you asked, you know, like what is interesting about the Cybertruck, like especially now that I've revealed on air that I don't really know anything about cars at all. And it's because it connects to this phenomenon, the contemporary reality, which is that like so many people are obsessed with extending their lives in one way or another. Like there's this kind of like evangelism or the sort of like religious fervor that is connected to like living forever. And the Cybertruck speaks to that too, right? Maybe I can stay safe until full right. self-driving is truly online, and then I won't have to engage in the risky activity that is driving a car anymore.
Well, and also maybe I can stay safe until I can fully download myself into the cloud.
Absolutely. That's
cloud.
Right.
Because part
That's
of
right, until the singularity.
Yeah, well, there are two trends that kind of exacerbate each other. I mean, one is sort of the individualist approach to safety and protection. You know, it's not like we're going to be safe by coming together, mutual aid, forming a association and changing society. People who buy Cybertrucks presumably think of those as crazy crackpot ideas. And then there's also the, like, we're turning over more and more of the messy business of life to, you know, autonomous machines, whether they're cars or the AI in our phone. And there's something deeply upsetting about both of these to me. So, deeply upsetting as these topics are, your piece in The Nation in the November issue is deeply entertaining as well. And that is a really tough act to pull off. So thanks so much for coming to The Nation podcast.
Thank you. It was delightful to talk to you. Thanks a lot.